Yes.
So the goal is to have this to be a discussion, but like I do have like specific, you know, work, you know, from Reza, which I can, you know, we'll like start by talking about, but then like it would be great if this like goes off of that and like, you know, goes into other things. That's fantastic. So basically this is, so like what I'll talk about is so a continuation or work which is a continuation of the work which I talk about, which I talked about in my like main presentation. And this is work which was really, again, primarily driven by Reza. It's work in progress. And then some of the data which was got this for this work was done in, you know, it was done in collaboration with Gunnar. And then we've had help from, and are continuing to have help from Matt Rockman and Elaine. So Matt Rockman is a quantitative genetics guy at NYU. Elaine is a statistician who's right now at Berkeley. She's a postdoc at Berkeley, and we've had a lot of help from the two of them in trying to understand stuff. And here's a picture from Reza, if you can't see him from there. So I'm just gonna like, you know, just start by just reminding about some stuff. So like, this, what we're seeing right here, is the first mitotic division in C. elegans taken with a fluorescence microscopy. All right, and so what you can see, I'll wait for it to loop again, is that, so these are two pronuclei, and then what you're gonna have is basically the spindle starting to form, the DNA's in the middle, the spindle elongates and oscillates, and it's positioned asymmetrically. It's a little hard to see on the projector right now, but the division plane is gonna line up with the position of the spindle, which is not at the center of the cell, all right? And so then, you know, this talk is about this type of phenomena. Just a word of background, just for people who, I don't know, don't know other aspects of what we do in lab. Most of what we're trying to do in lab is study biophysics of this type of process and similar things in other organisms, where a lot of it is trying to have some, you know, really quantitative understanding about how different aspects of this really work. So how does a spindle assemble? How does it move, elongate, and segregate chromosomes? And we try to get essentially some, you know, do very quantitative measurements, and then the goal being having some type of mathematical model of this process. And now, like, you know, what I'm interested in is, so like what I talked about before is Reza's work on understanding evolution of the spindle, and some of the question is basically how can we combine this type of work with this kind of cellular biophysics type work. And so I'm going to give like a super quick summary of the talk, you know, kind of the relevant parts of my talk for people who weren't there. And so the basic gist, because it's going to be relevant for what I want to just say now, is that, okay, so if you care about evolution of the spindle, how does evolution of the spindle happen? So when I say evolution of the spindle, I mean like, you know, understanding current diversity in spindle, you know, structure and function, if you will. And so at some point in the past, you know, like you had a bunch of spontaneous mutations, and then selection, population dynamics, genetic drift, recombination, other things, somehow like, you know, sort this variation. And on short time scales, that gives within species variation, and at long time scales, that gives between species variation. Of course, this is true for basically evolution of anything, but also particularly true for the spindle. And so what I talked about last time is that Reza basically tried to study those processes for the spindle in C. elegans. And so one of the things which he did in order to do that is he developed a really very high throughput way of imaging the first mitotic spindle in C. elegans. And so what you see here is now not with fluorescence but with DIC, you can still see the similar processes that you have two pronuclei come together, then they make the spindle, and the spindle oscillates and elongates, and then you eventually get the division plane between them. And so in addition to developing this kind of like way of imaging, Reza developed image analysis tools so he could really track the behavior of the spindle in detail in these type of movies. And so for example, he can do stuff like measure, okay, so this is one pole of the spindle, that's the other pole. He can measure the length of the spindle as a function of time. You see it starts at some initial size, it elongates to get to some final size. And then you can see that the spindle oscillates. And then these blue things, this is basically centrosomes. And so you can measure the size of the centrosome and how that changes over time. You can measure the division plane, just a whole bunch of stuff. Okay. And again, this is just a summary of aspects of what we talked about last time. One thing Reza did is that he used this high throughput imaging to characterize 100 different C. elegans wild isolates that people had collected from all around the world. And you know, he imaged many, many embryos per isolate. And again, this is a reminder that one of the most important conclusions that from his work is that there's extensive standing genetic variation for essentially all aspects of spindle dynamics and morphology. And so what I mean by that, just so we're all on the same page, is that you know, if he characterized the final spindle length of an isolate taken from this, you know, this location, someone collected from this location, so these are three different individuals, they're all essentially genetically identical. They're all, you know, yeah, so they're all genetically identicalized, and they have some final spindle length. And so within this isolate, there's a bunch of genetically identical individuals, you get some distribution of the final length of the spindle. And if you look at another isolate collected from another location, you can see the final spindle length, again, within this isolate, within these genetically identical individuals, they're all very similar to each other, but if you look at the final length of spindles from this isolate, and you compare it to the final lengths from that isolate, they're different from each other. Yeah.
Just my imagination, is that a bigger embryo too?
So that's very, very interesting. And so like a lot of what the previous talk was about was how about, no, that's totally cool. And I'll allude to this before, or I'll allude to this later, is that essentially, well, we'll just hold off on that. And I'll just say the conclusion from the talk later. But that's, you're exactly right, and that's fantastic, very attentive looking. But let's pretend that all we were looking at is the final length of the spindle. What you would conclude from this, which is, I mean, it's true, is that there's standing genetic variation for final length of the spindle because different isolates are different from each other, right? And that's not just true for spindle length, it's true for basically everything else Russell looked at. Here's another example where you see centrosome size from one isolate that's small, another isolate that's large. And in fact, if you look at, so now this is the, now this is looking at for each of the 97 isolates, what is the average embryo size from, oh, sorry, sorry, so what's the average centrosome size from guys in those isolates, and you can see it varies by a factor of essentially two. And so that's large, I would say, but a, you know, large standing genetic variation for centrosome size.
And have you guys ever actually turned this into a heritability
measure? Oh, yeah, no. So if you recall from what I was saying from the last talk, yeah, and so like we did the formal full quantitative genetics of everything. But I think for illustrative purposes, we will
I don't remember where the numbers are.
Oh, the heritabilities, do you remember?
You have to back up your measurement error variance, I guess.
Yeah, it's like about a 0.1 or something like that, was that right? Yeah, okay, 0.1.
In all of these features, or this is already the centrosome size?
Feature to feature, but on average, in 15, 22, up to more than 20.
That sounds like a global one.
And so then basically like, and so Reza did a whole bunch of other stuff. And then the take home message is, and again, I'm not gonna explain like how he came to this conclusion, but I'll just explain it, that if you really characterize how spontaneous mutations affect the spindle, so you can just measure that, and you postulate that you have stabilizing selection on embryo size, because many of these traits are correlated with embryo size, that is sufficient to quantitatively explain the level of within variation, within species variation for all aspects of the spindle that Reza looked at, as well as in fact, even level of between species variation spindles and nematodes over roughly 100 million years of evolution. So that was a previous talk.
So can you just tell us about like how you conceived of this project in the first place? So you're interested in the evolution spindle, and then you pick this model organism for some reason, or?
Yeah, and so okay, because, well, okay, so because if you want to study something like evolution of the spindle, which is, because I became interested in that for my own personal, or like our own personal reasons, basically. But then you need a system where you can basically investigate all these different things. And so it helps, for example, having a system where people have done a lot of like population genetics work on. So there's a lot of like infrastructure there that you can use. And then also for this, because a lot of it was measuring wild isolates as well as different species, you want to be able to do very quantitative measurements without using transgenics. And then you need something where you can actually like, yeah, measure what you want to measure. And actually that by itself, that really rapidly limits what organisms you can use. And it ends up that C. elegans is one you can. There are other which should also be possible, but it ends up that C. elegans is particularly amenable. Well, C. elegans and other nematodes. Okay, and so then two things which came away from this is like I was saying before. One is that there's large standing genetic variation for all these traits, all these cell biological traits. And two, that somehow the fact that, you know, traits scale with cell size is an interesting thing that one perhaps wants to mechanistically understand. Okay, and so then now the idea is that now how can we use, or you know, can we, or how can we use this quantitative within this quantitative genetic variation within species, combine it with cell biophysical stuff, not just to learn about like the evolution of the spindle, but to learn now kind of mechanistic stuff about how the spindle's working, right? And so that's what the conversation should be about today, or that's what the idea is. And so basically, you know, Rez is doing this, and I'll say like what some of the reasons why I think this is interesting and how one can do this in practice. But again, it's great to hear other people's thoughts and ideas. I mean, so like, in my mind, so like, basically I'm going to step through what I think, or what we think are kind of three of the main, you know, but yeah, like I said, Rez is the one who did everything, so he's here. And you know, three of the main reasons why, different perspectives why this are interesting, and then I'll kind of say these two things, or, you know, these three things, I'll go into more detail. But I think basically both, you know, this is from a genetics perspective, from a biophysics perspective, and it allows me to do, and I'll refer to, and I'll go into detail what I mean about this later, but what people call causal analysis, which is basically just, well, I'll explain what I mean by that later on.
Yeah, casual analysis.
Oh, casual, oh, oops, pause too. Well, it's casual too, yeah, this is also be a relaxed thing, yeah, yeah.
Maybe you mentioned this exactly. In your talk, I wasn't here when you'd spoken, but yeah. You said that this thing, much of this is between species differences or also?
No, sorry. So those, all those differences I was showing you initially, that was all within species.
Right, I thought on your conclusion slide that you'd had a...
It ends up that the same idea that if all you have is stabilizing selection on embryo size, the fact that these traits are correlated with embryo size, both can quantitatively explain the within species variation of all these traits and the between species variation.
I understand you did your measurements in species. You don't present
So we do have measurements on 40 different species of nematodes of the same type of measurement.
Right. I'm just saying you don't have, obviously you don't have 100 isolates from.
Oh, yeah, and so for the different species, so there are whatever three species where we have like roughly 15 isolates each, and then for most of the other species, it's, you know, one, two, or three isolates.
And presumably you'll tell us a bit about the genetics of this, but is that also true from a physiological perspective? So I presume that if you, I don't know, starve embryos, you can make them smaller and do these things. All vary in parallel.
There's a couple points. So first of all, that's a super interesting question, which we have not explored in detail, and that's definitely something which I think is really interesting. Another point which I just want to make really clear is that it's not the case that if you know the size of the embryo, you know the size of these other traits. It's not like the size of the spindle is always like whatever half the size of the embryo. It is correlated with it.
Right.
Some of these traits are actually quite weakly correlated. And so there are many other things which are determining them mechanistically. It just ends up that there is a correlation with the cell size. But that's a super interesting question, and we haven't looked at it yet. But we would, yeah. I mean, we did some preliminary work in that regard, but I haven't really, yeah.
So you'd expect some but minimal overlap in, say, QTL analysis from the process for these different traits.
Well, okay, so this is a question, exactly. So this is the toughest of the question. So you're getting at exactly what we're talking about next. Yeah, exactly. And so just to build off of that, right? Okay, so then what we did, so Matt Rockman, like I said, is a quantitative genetics guy, and he, for totally, you know, his own purposes, what he did when he was with Lena Krugliak's lab, and now he's at NYU as a faculty himself, when he was with Krugliak, he took two of these isolates, N2 and this guy's from Hawaii, so people call it the Hawaiian line, N2 and the Hawaiian line, and because at the time, so N2 is a standard lab strain. At the time when he did this, this was the one which genetically was most diverse from N2. He took these two, did 10 generations of crossing them together, and then did 10 generations of selfing. And then what you have is then you have 200 different lines. Each one has different combination of genes from these original two parents. Okay? So he made these, and then he basically, and so the parent lines are sequenced, and the other lines are genotyped. So effectively, it's like as if one essentially sequenced all these 200 lines.
So how different is that? I mean, how many SNPs distinguish N2 from
one in every 1,000.
What's the difference between a real and a rail? Real is just a recombination.
Oh, I guess like this advanced is that there are multiple, many, many generations of.
That's
I don't
what
know.
A real is.
A rail? I thought a rail could be anything where you just have. I don't know. I just use this is what the language Matt uses. From my, he knows more than me, so I adopt his language.
I mean, what's the advanced? What's advanced about it?
Well, I meant advanced here means it's gone for many generations.
Right? Yeah, that's what the advanced is.
Okay. Take them all away in the end.
Okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So it could be that it's. It could be. Okay, so then you know, like, so then a lot of people have used these lines for many, many different things. So then what Reza did is that for each of these roughly 200 lines, he imaged 50 embryos per line, you know, and did the same type of analysis. And the first thing which is interesting is that if you look at the two parents, so it ends up, actually, these moves aren't synchronized, so it's not so great. But it ends up that, you know, I said there's all this genetic variation, but it ends up that if you look at N2 in Hawaiian, for these particular traits, which Reza looked at, it ends up they're very, very similar to each other for basically all these traits, you know, size of the centrosome, length of the spindle, whatever. But if you look at these intercross lines, you can have huge differences. Okay? And so what that tells you is that these guys look the same, but they're the same for different reasons, right? Or, you know, they have the same phenotype, but there's a different genetic basis for that. And so people, you know, I'm sure many people who are familiar with these type of studies, people do these type of studies for a wide variety of traits and a wide variety of organisms, these similar type of things. But I think the idea of using this type of studies for cell bio has some really interesting aspects to it. And I think there's, I mean, interesting both for cell bio and then also more broadly, I would argue that there's really interesting things about this. So the standard thing which people try to use lines like this for is to understand like the genetic basis of stuff. And the reason I would say, for example, I think what's interesting in this particular case, right, is for the spindle, we know huge number of genes involved in the spindle, you know, like literally hundreds. And so people know that both from a lot of very, very good traditional, you know, molecular and cell bio studies, but then people have also in the last, whatever, 10, 15 years done a lot of studies where they take, you know, many different organisms and they systematically knock down every gene in the organism one at a time and they ask what genes influence the spindle. And both, you know, or you just isolate a whole spindle, you just mass spec the whole thing, right? And so we know hundreds of genes which aren't involved in the spindle, right?
Can I ask one other question?
Oh, yeah, sure.
This interesting phenomenon. So you say all this variation appears at the end of this intercross.
Yes.
Did the variability arise early on as well in F1s or F2s, or does it require back crossing to?
It's not back crossing, but even crossing to homozygosity.
Yeah.
And so we haven't looked at any of the other generations. However, you know, because C. elegans is selfing, like even like the wild guys are basically essentially homozygotic for everything.
That addresses that.
And so it's like one question which I think is very interesting for a lot of cell bio traits, right? And this is one thing which I think this whole like quantitative genetic stuff is interesting for, is that you can start asking, are the genes responsible for variation in the spindle the same as the things that we think of as being like responsible for the spindle, right? Because I mean, you know, it's not at all obvious. In fact, I'm not really aware of like data one way or the other. And one thing which I think is very cool, so Rezanov was super nervous about this stuff, because one could imagine that you do, okay, right. So then the basic idea, if you aren't familiar with these type of experiments, is that you measure some, I mean, there are a million ways to do this, but the simplest way you could think about it is you have some phenotype you're measuring on these different isolates. And then you have, and so you have these 200 different isolates, right? And then for every part of the, you know, for every part of the genome of one of these isolates that either came from the N2 or the Hawaiian, right? And as you know, and as you've genotyped all those guys, you can basically just ask, is there some association between your trait and the genotype of the guy at a certain location? And if you have some strong association, then you call that a QTL, a quantitative trait loci, which means that you have some region on the genome which is correlated with some, you know, change in your trait. And so presumably in that region, there's some differences in DNA, which is responsible for, you know, causing the phenotypic variation which you see. But one thing which like Reza and I were super nervous about is that we can certainly imagine that like, you know, he does all these measurements and that you take stuff and that you don't see associated with anything. And that you'd be really depressed. I think there's still a lot one could say, but it would really suck. But one thing which I think is interesting is that basically every trait that Reza has looked at, I mean, that's not entirely true, but nearly every trait that Reza has looked at, you can see significant QTLs and often multiple QTLs. And so I think that's really interesting and promising and just shows that this is like, you know, presumably like a general productive way to look at cell, to study cell bio stuff.
I've never looked at these kinds of graphs deeply before, but this threshold that you put over there, there seems to be a lot of correlation even below the threshold for these two very different traits. Is that meaningful?
Yeah, no, so this is a super, you know, this becomes a very interesting thing, okay? Because the most naive thing you can do is just pretend everything's independent of everything else and just say, if this was the case, and then I have some kind of like multiple testing hypothesis, then if things go above this line, they're significant. If they don't, they're not significant, and just do that, right? But now you can imagine in doing much more sophisticated things, and so it potentially is. But then this becomes, starts to get to like quite complicated statistics. But that's I think that's a super interesting challenge of how to do that appropriately. Yeah, and I think, yeah.
Are there issues with how well you can resolve the regions, or are there inversions, or is that something you have to deal with?
Well, so one thing which becomes a practical issue is that the size of these regions depends very strongly where they are in the chromosome, because it has to do with the rate of recombination at that part. And so then I forget like what's the range, but it's like if you're like in a good region, maybe you have like of order tens of variations between, you know, possible genetic variations between N2 and Y at the location, so of order 10 different things. If you're in a bad region, then it could be like hundreds.
The SNP distribution is relatively uniform, but the crossover frequency is not.
So the SNP distribution is not uniform. I don't recall the Yeah, definitely people have looked at this. I don't recall the details, but I don't believe.
Much higher resolution than.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, no, no, definitely, definitely. It's much higher resolution.
That's not limiting at all.
You know, so the main thing which is limiting you is the number of recombinations you had in making the line. So that's definitely the thing which is limiting you.
And that, and you said that, that ranges from like tens of genes to hundreds of genes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But then what you can do is that, of course, like if you look in some region, well, okay, now with CRISPR, you can imagine like really like, you know, doing cool stuff. Okay, so I think this is certainly super interesting and super important, but personally, there are other areas which I think are even more exciting about combining quantitative genetics and this kind of cell biophysics.
You raised this issue, I mean, are you going to overlay that for us with what's been learned from knockdown experiments?
No. No, because, okay, because this is all work in progress. And so this is all just, yeah, so we're not there yet. But this is just showing you, yeah, just kind of, I don't know, where we're going with this.
I
want to
say
that one interesting thing also is that we can look at like the correlation
between
traits. Of course. Yeah. I mean, do you see, for example, if you look at like correlation between spindle length and embryocyte, a very nice peak that, you know, gets super strong to explain the, you know, what controls the correlation.
Right. So you're, I mean, what you're saying is you can define a trait as an individual trait, like spindle length or embryo size, or you can try to define a trait as correlation between spindle length and embryo size. And those, example, those are distinct traits.
Exactly.
And then, for example, like the key here that you see for that correlation between a spindle length and embryo size, I mean, you don't, I mean, it's like somewhere on embryo size, on chromosome 3, that even there's nothing there.
Yeah, there's nothing there for basically any of the other traits. Yeah.
If you look at the correlation, it's a very, very strong, you know, probability of 8 or something, 10.
Still, it'd be cool. I mean, as you say, there've been all these knockdown studies, and you could take the phenotypic results and just overlay that on top of here, as I'm sure you've looked at for, you know, things that might be candidates with this line.
Definitely.
For C. elegans, particularly, people did like genome-wide RNA. That's also right.
Yeah, and they've also took movies, and so then so one can use the Reza's software and really like look at essentially similar traits. Okay, and so this is very much kind of the standard type of thing that people would typically do if they were, you know, looking at, you know, recombinant inbred lines and stuff like that. But I think that there are a number of things which are, there's additional things one could do which I think is very interesting and exciting. And so, you know, because, like I said, so like, you know, my lab and a billion other people's labs, right, you know, they're trying to develop some biophysical model of some cellular process, right? And so then you can ask, okay, so how can I, how can one, in theory, relate the results of a biophysical model to like quantitative genetic data? Like, you know, what's the, you know, and I think those really interesting things. And so one thing which I think, which I'm really attracted by is if I have a picture is that like, so, right, so like normally, if you think of like what we do in biophysics is that you develop some model, which is often like, you know, some whatever differential equation that has some parameters in it. And this model tells you, you know, like, okay, you know, like if you were to like poke the spindle, like, you know, like how, you know, much does it like run away from you, right? And this is, and you figure that out by solving your equations with the parameters you have, right? And that's normally how we do physics as well as cellular biophysics, right? But in this case, if you look across, for example, these different lines, each line, if you were to think about this language, has slightly different parameters, right? And so now it's like you're kind of twiddling the parameters of your model, and then you see, like, you know, what's the result? And so, like, personally, I think that's super interesting, because another way to say it is that, like, any biophysical model you write down has some prediction for, you know, the pattern of correlations you should see across lines. And so then one could say that this is a way, a completely different way, to like study, you know, these type of cellular biophysical models, which one normally has. And so you can kind of go either way, right? So on one hand, you could say, okay, here's my own theory, which I started with for whatever reason. Now I can like, you know, essentially like tailor expand it in the parameters and predict what the correlations should be like across traits, do I see that or not? But then I think what's also equally exciting is one can go the other way And so one could say, let's pretend I don't have any model at all. I don't know what the right model is. I observe correlations across lines. Can I use this to help me figure out what the right model is in some cellular biophysics sense? And I'll give an example of that just so people know what I'm talking about. So for example, I mentioned before that the final length of the spindle is strongly correlated with size of the cell, right? So, what I mean by final length is that the spindle starts at some initial length, it elongates and it gets to some final length. And so then, it's natural to ask, why does the final length of the spindle, why is it correlated with cell size? Why are these two dependent on each other, right? And then you can ask more generally, so what is determining the final length of the spindle? And then just to get you guys in the right frame, I'll write down a couple of like super general possible classes of models. So one can imagine some timer mechanism, right? So you can imagine what happens is that you have one mechanism which kind of assembles the spindle and determines the initial length of the spindle. And then another mechanism says, how long does the spindle elongate for? And then you get to, how long, you elongate, for a certain period of time, and then you get to whatever final length you get to, once you're done. Right? So this would be like a timer mechanism. And so this could be very reasonable because, again, there's some biophysics which causes a spindle to assemble, and then maybe the spindle just elongates to as long as you're in anaphase, and therefore, like, the amount of time you elongate has something to do with the cell cycle dynamics, which is just some totally separate mechanistic process. But I can imagine another class of models. Like, maybe what happens is that some mechanism determines how big your initial spindle is, and then you basically elongate until you hit the side of the cell, right? In which case, this is like a constraints model, right? And so then, right, so that's a completely different class of models, right? Or one can imagine another completely different class of models that, again, I mean, these are just like three, like, I won't say random examples. These are three ideas which people have actually proposed. But of course, one could imagine a billion others. But okay, so maybe you have a limiting component model. Maybe what happens is that you have I don't believe this, I'm not saying I like any of these models. I'm just saying one could imagine there's one mechanism that determines how big the spindle is initially, and then the spindle grows until all the tubulinus in the cytoplasm has become incorporated in the spindle, and the final size of the spindle is just, determined by how much tubulin you have in the cell. Yeah.
Irrespective of the genetics, how much variation is there just based on conditions in which you grow? If you change the temperature,
yeah. So there's
ionic strength.
Yeah. Kind of stuff. So there's definitely not ionic strength, but temperature. There's definitely variation based on that.
Okay.
Definitely.
I mean, could that explain some of the differences between species, and maybe a wide species shows differences because you're growing all the strains under the same conditions?
Well, we could, again, I think this relates more to the previous talk, and I strongly think not. But I would have to give other justifications, and I think maybe we should talk about that later because I think that really involves the subject of the previous talk. I mean, it's definitely interesting, but it's, because at least in the lab, under the same conditions, they are different, so there's genetic differences for these things. You could ask, like, what does this mean in some, in the real world, which I think was a very interesting question, but we should maybe chat about that later.
I think that all these three dimensional theories are the same in the sense that they all include, mechanistically include, the parameter that you're thinking about, which in this case is the size of the cell.
It's a
mechanistic requirement for something. While in principle, you can construct a different class of theories in which these two things are correlated with some concern that you don't see.
Definitely. Definitely, 100%, 100%. But you're totally right. I mean, like, but let's just bear with me for a moment. I just want to make the one point, this one point. But then we'll come back to your thing in a moment. But you're 100% right. But what I want to say is that these models by themselves do make different predictions. And so these, in fact, are different. There are plenty of other models like what you're proposing, but just these three models are different. And so, for example, in one way. And this is just doing nothing fancy, is that if one looks across the recombinant inbred lines, right, and just measures the correlation between just these three different chains, straights, the length of the cell, the final length of the spindle, and the initial length of the spindle. Right? What you see is, like I was saying before, the final length of the spindle is strongly correlated to the length of the cell. That's true. Right? But what you also see is that the final length of the spindle is completely is essentially uncorrelated with the initial length of the spindle. Right? And the point is that that by itself is a very like non-trivial statement. Right? And so the reason is that with the simplest version of this timer model, which I was just proposing, like I was saying, you would have one mechanism which determines the initial size of the spindle, another mechanism determines how you elongate, and then if you have genetic variation for those two mechanisms, that would predict a correlation between the initial length of the spindle and the final length of the spindle. Right? Because if you happen to be bigger, because the amount you grow doesn't know anything about, how big you are by, that's how I'm postulating for this theory, then that would predict if you happen to be bigger, you would grow to a larger size, right? You don't see that. In fact, you see the opposite, right? So that basically shows you that the simplest version of this timer model cannot be correct. So do people get the argument?
What is the initial
length? Oh, you mean like mechanistically? Well, it's a sigmoid, so it's a quite well-defined thing. So you can really. Yeah, exactly.
I didn't get this argument.
Okay. So now I'm proposing a very particular model, right? Okay, in this very particular model, one mechanism determines the initial size of the spindle. Mechanism two determines how long you elongate. And these are two mechanisms which, by I'm postulating, know nothing about each other.
And this was true for all New York City versions.
No. That's true only for the this is not the case, right? So we're saying one mechanism. I'll repeat this again. One mechanism determines the initial length. The other mechanism determines, the amount of time you elongate. Okay. So now imagine that I have. Now, if these are two separate mechanisms which don't know anything about each other, then now I look across my, Reza looks across the lines, and some guys have genetic variations such that their initial spindle is a little bit higher, and some have it that the initial spindle is a little bit lower. You look across the lines, some guys have it that the spindle elongates a little bit more, some guys have it that elongates a little bit less. Now, if by postulate these two mechanisms don't know anything about each other, right, then if I have a line, let's say I have a line which elongates for a certain amount, if guys tend to be larger, the final length would be larger. If guys tend to be smaller, the final length would be smaller, right? But you don't see that. Yeah. I'll contrast this with, let's say this constraints model. If what happens is you just elongate until you hit the edge of the cell, no matter what your initial length of the spindle is, it doesn't matter. Your length is just going to be determined by the size of the cell, right? And so that is a model where hypothetically these two things would be uncorrelated. Again, for the simplest version.
If you describe logistic growth, right, you get a sigmoid growth curve and there's no real initial length, really, right? The spindle just starts growing logistically, right? It's initially rising.
Well, so then we would call this plateau. We would call this plateau. So, like, if you have a sigmoid, if you're like this, it ends up like empirically, you can simply just, well, again, in the case of the spindle, you can really just, it really is very well fit by a sigmoid. And so you really do have some.
I believe the data fit the curve, but, under logistic growth, there's no really specific point.
No, it's not a specific point. It's not, so like, it's the limit, if you will, the limit that t goes to infinity, the curve and the limit that t goes to infinity. That's the initial. Negative infinity. Yes, negative infinity. That would be the initial length.
From cell biology,
there's an inner cell.
Like,
Yeah, yeah, so the spindle really does, you know, sits there.
I'm seeing those, it just looks, maybe it will cover this when you're looking at home, but it has some resource and you're just initially growing from there.
Well, no, so, but then, oh, okay, but in that case, your initial length would be zero. In the system model you just said, your initial size would be zero, because you would say, like, if you're growing from zero and you grow in this fashion, then if you went to t goes to negative infinity, you would get to zero. So that would be like your, what we would call like the initial size. It ends up that's not the way the spindle is. It's some non-zero value. And so as Reza was saying, you really have a spindle that's like sitting there and you can look at it. And this is essentially the spindle sitting in metaphase, basically. And then, so it sits here for a little bit and then it elongates.
And you can see that in the
images. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so like for me, I think this is like a super interesting thing because this is like a completely different way in, you know, probing, you know, cellular mechanisms.
The uniformity in spindle growth rate.
And so there's also variation in that, and there's, yeah, there's genetic variation for that too. There's variation from line to line, and then there's, and you can get QTLs for elongation rate as well. Okay, so now I'll talk about casual analysis. well, it's good that I actually wrote casual analysis, but I did it subconsciously because people call it causal analysis. When you talk about like really establishing cause, then like other people get really like mad at you, and then you yell back and forth. And so like let's forget about the details of the words, and then talk about like the like what the idea is. So the idea basically is just that you can go beyond simple correlation, and you can learn a lot by doing that. And so it's about inferring casual relationships between traits by studying both correlations and partial correlations across lines. And then I'm gonna give some specific examples just to like, you know, show what I'm talking about. Let's pretend, now I'm just postulating, that I have three traits, A, B, and C, right? And A causes B causes C, right? Then, okay, like in general, you know, like I'd expect all these guys to be correlated with each other, but if you condition on B, if you hold B fixed, then A and C become uncorrelated. And so to give you a very concrete example of that, so people have proposed that what happens that the size of the cell determines the size of the centrosome, and the size of the centrosome determines the size of the spindle, right? So, again, I'm not saying I like this model or don't like this model. I'm just like giving a concrete example of like a possible model, right? So if this were true, then if Reza looks across these different lines, then what you would see is obviously these three things would be correlated with each other. But if you consider, you know, for a given centrosome size, if you will, spindle length does not depend on cell size. Okay.
So this assumes that there isn't some other.
No, so literally I'm assuming this. I'm assuming this and nothing else.
You could have an environmental factor.
You could have a billion other things. I'm assuming literally this. And so I'm saying if we assume literally this, what are the implications? I'm not saying I believe in this model or if I observe this, it implies that. I'm just saying like, you know, like this is, I'm just asserting that this is a possibility. But you're totally right. There are many, many other possibilities besides this.
But so you're saying that because you use this language, hold B constant, you're saying there's absolutely nothing else influencing C.
That's right. I'm imagining some make-believe world where like this is literally what's happening. And there's literally nothing else in the whole world. There's no other variables besides cell size, centrosome size, and spindle length. So nothing else in the world exists. Again, so, you know, obviously we don't live in that world, but let's just pretend we did, right?
So how is this different than the example you were just giving, right? I mean, you're just saying, so if there's no correlation between A and B, and there's no inherent relationship between A and B, and no inherent relationship between B and C, then...
Let me elaborate. Okay, so this is one possible example. Of course, I could also imagine that I have, in fact, C causes B causes A, right? And if this were true, it would also be the case that if I condition on, so these guys could all be correlated, but I condition on B, and these two now become uncorrelated, right? It's the same thing, right? And I could also be the case that B causes A and C, and then it's a similar story. All right, but imagine another case. And so all of these kind of are the same, more or less, right? But imagine this case. A and B cause, A and C cause B. Yeah?
You can distinguish between the direction of the arrows, right? Because you have some distribution of C, right? If it's conditional on B, then, and you uncondition it, the distribution is going to be narrow, right? Because you're looking at some part of it.
I don't think that's...
Well, in the second case, right, conditioning on B will not change distribution.
I'm not sure what you mean. Yeah, and in fact, there's kind of theorems which show that actually there's no observation. If this is literally your three possibilities, there's no just purely observational thing you can do to tell any difference between these guys. These are all identical for any like partial correlations and correlations are all the same. This guy is different.
I don't understand your third one. Why is that make A and C uncorrelated?
Because I'm pretending that like these guys normally talk to each other through B, but then I stop the part which talks to them, and then they can kind of do, so part of them maybe does their own thing, and part of them goes through B. And so normally they kind of talk to each other, normally kind of like B tells them both what to do, so they have some correlation, but if B isn't telling the two what to do, then he's doing his own thing, and he's doing his own, and she's doing her own thing, and then they don't know. Or maybe it's like, in some generic sense, would be like less correlated. But like, let's just, for simply, let's say uncorrelated. Do you get what I'm trying to say?
I don't. Let's say B is the amount of gasoline I have in my gas tank. And A is my car stopping on the road, running out of gas. And C is the weight of my car, or something like that. No,
so if you condition on B, that means that you already know that you've run out of gas. And you're saying, given that I've run out of gas, you could imagine that these two talk to each other by some other path, but I'm assuming that doesn't happen. I'm saying if they only talk to each other through B, by B causing both, then this is true. This is not like a generic state. I mean, in reality, there are other things going on, and it's all more complicated. But like...
I see. So if only.
Yeah. This is only these things and nothing else in the world happening.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. But if we only have this, right? Now, if this is what's happening, this is different, right? Because in this case, if you condition on B, A and C become more correlated. Right. And so the reason is imagine that B equals A plus C. Right. Now, if I know B is very low and A is, high, then C must be really, really small because the two added together give you B.
Assuming both are positive.
Yeah, just to give you some, right. And so like this is very special. This is different from these other things. So in other words, If like God tells you that you have one of these four possibilities, and only one of these four possibilities, by observation, you can tell this one from those three. These three, you can't tell them apart. If this is all you know, it's just observation. Is that?
That's also if A and C are negatively correlated a priori. So if A and C are negatively correlated to begin with, and you're saying that even if you condition on B, they will become
Okay, so right now, for what I'm saying, I'm just assuming that A and C, so they don't talk to each other by any other path besides B, so they're not negatively or positively correlated.
They could be negatively correlated through B.
So they could be negatively correlated through B. Exactly.
But they don't have to be, I guess, with your example.
Yeah.
That only happens. They could be negative.
Yeah.
No, they can't be negative. they're independent, the way you've drawn everything else.
The way I've drawn it right now, they're independent. The way I've drawn it right now, they're independent. Yeah, but it ends up that so the way I've drawn it, they're independent, and these are the only things. But the point is that like the basic idea here generalizes to some extent to other cases, and so the idea is that if you have some part of some large network around this, and so these are what people call colliders, and these are special. And so the idea is that if you have some like region, you know, like large more stuff around it. Depending on the details of that other thing, it may be possible to distinguish this guy from these other guys by conditioning. Where in general, like these guys, you cannot get arrows from conditioning alone.
I'm confused why they're working more correlate A. Without B, they are not correlated at all.
Yeah, no, that's...
Correlate.
Yeah, no, it's your...
B makes them correlate.
Yeah, no, so you're totally right. And so in this particular case, yeah, no, you're 100% right. And so like the reason I kind of snuck that word in is that like, you know, normally you're part of a larger network, and then given certain conditions on the other large network, you know, if you condition on this one, you can get the guys to become more, they may have some amount of correlation from other stuff. And if you condition, they should still become more correlated instead of like going from none.
The example above, it should be less correlated.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Statement is not true. It's possible to cook up weird scenarios where
that's what I said.
Uncorrelated when they're collided.
Yeah, no, exactly. Is that so? I didn't. Sorry. So I tried to be correct with my language. I might have misspoke. And that is that. It's not the case that this is some like foolproof thing that always works or anything like that. This is under certain conditions.
It's casual.
It's casual, exactly.
Third one in the top category makes A and B uncorrelated. Suppose I have a particularly simple dependence. C is equal to B and A is equal to B. A condition of B
is equal to C. Right, but you have to say plus noise for each one.
Well, plus noise. So unaffected.
What?
But then A and C are uncorrelated.
Yeah.
Right. And C are still uncorrelated. They wind up.
Yeah, the noises. Yeah, then the noise would be uncorrelated.
Right.
Yeah. No. So it works in that case. Okay. And so then, what? And again, this is not some generic. This is not some foolproof thing. But the idea is essentially that in certain circumstances, one can use the fact that colliders are special, And then this is the other thing which is very cool about this, is that you also can make another assumption, which is that genes cause phenotypes, not the other way around. Which, in the absence of selection, that's a good assumption. Okay, and then the game is stuff like that. So this is one type of thing which people do, which I think is interesting, right? Okay, so for example, like I was saying before, if all you have are your three traits A, B, and C, and this is all you knew in the world, you observe them, there's nothing you can do to tell if it's this or that, if this is literally all you had, just the observations of A, B, and C. So like any conditioning on them, these will give identical results. But if you actually map QTLs for each one of these, then these become different. Right, and so for example, the correlation, because you know the direction of a QTL to a trait, right, you can put these arrows in, and then by conditioning on traits, you can look at the interaction between traits and QTL or whatever, and then in theory, you can figure out, you know, arrows for other things. Is that clear? So for example, we'll give a good example. In some sense, what you can think about, this is the equivalent of a standard gene knockdown experiment, right? So what is a standard experiment which one does in cell bio? So I want to know, is the size of the centrosome, okay, the size of the centrosome is correlated with the size of the, so one way I could ask this question of, Is it the case that cell size causes centrosome size causes spindle length? If I want to know if that's true, the standard thing that I would do, I would find a gene that I knock down and I change centrosome size without affecting cell size. Right? And if I do this gene knockdown and I see that centrosome size changes and spindle length changes, now independent of cell size, I say that I was right. And so that's the standard thing I would do, like in a knockdown experiment. But the point is that it's a totally equivalent thing.
But I don't know. So here in this case, the QTLs are not defined separately. The QTLs are defined by measuring all the correlations and doing all the conditional things and everything, and then you get the QTLs.
Well, and so there's a practical question of how do you do it in practice. And so in practice, you could either try to do that, or you could simply kind of blindly correlate QTL to traits, in which case you might have a QTL. Let's pretend I correlate QTLs, and you could, this is kind of a similar argument. Let's say I have QTL1 that's correlated with both cell size and spindle length. And I have two possibilities. This QTL, or at least two possibilities, this QTL independently affects both cell size and spindle length, or only affects cell size, and cell size affects spindle length. I can differentiate this, because I look up for this QTL, and if I condition on cell size, does that block the effect on spindle length? It's just the same idea.
Still assuming that your world consists of A, B, and C, right? So if you have, if D, which we don't know about, is responsible for A, B, and C, right? QTL 1, 2, and 3 all affect D.
Wait a second. So you're saying if you have some common cause.
That's right.
If I have some common cause, no, but that you could tell, right? So in that case, you could tell it, right? Because in this case, if I condition.
Yeah, shared QTL, right. So this is actually formally the same as your other model where B causes A and C. And in that case, QTL 2 always has an effect on A, B, and C.
Yeah, no, exactly, this type of thing, exactly. Or another way to say it is that in general, so maybe all these QTLs are correlated with C, in which case that could be due to common cause. But then if I hold B fixed, if I lose the correlation between these guys and then, you know, like don't get a, you know, like when I saw the correlation with QTL3, then I know that's not the case. It's not a common cause. Unless there's, yeah, I mean, again, one can imagine nightmare scenarios, but like assuming you don't have a nightmare scenario, that's right. And so this sounds all very abstract, but I'll just be a little bit more concrete about it. And so this isn't using the QTLs, but it's the same idea. And so just to be more concrete about it. So now, but this is, yeah, it's basically the same idea. So let's forget about QTLs. And just now consider, in addition to cell length, final spindle length, and initial spindle length, I'll do what I call cell volume, which is really not, I won't be technical about it. You know, it's not really cell volume, but let's pretend it's cell volume, because, you know, whatever. Okay, so now I see that the final spindle length is correlated both with the length of the cell and the volume of the cell. Okay, all right. So now let's think about this limiting component model. In the simplest version of the limiting component model, if I have a larger cell, I have more tubulin. Therefore, I should have a larger spindle. Right? If the spindle grows until like all the tubulin is inside the spindle. Right? In the simplest version of this constraints model, on the other hand, I just elongate till I hit the edge of the cell, in which case the size of the spindle should be correlated with the size of the cell, of the length of the cell, but not the volume, right? But it's correlated with both, so I feel like I'm kind of screwed, right?
Isn't cell length correlated with cell volume?
Exactly. This is the point. Exactly. So cell length and cell volume are correlated, highly correlated, so I feel like I'm screwed, right? So I'm like, okay, you know, what can I do? Okay. But the point is that now you can ask, and so I've just kind of drawn the result here, it ends up, if, in practice, if you condition on cell length, you are now, the final spindle is now independent of cell volume. And so you just look at the statistics across the line, if you hold, yeah, like, you know, like, and so like, yeah, right, so it's really like this. And so it's just that cell volume is correlated with cell length. And we don't know the direction of this arrow or if there's anything going on, whatever. But these guys are kind of correlated with each other. But really, it's cell length which is affecting final spindle size, not cell volume.
Okay,
cell volume, then same thing happens. Or no, something else happens.
Did you say that? If you condition on cell volume, yeah, no, then the cell length is still correlated with the
spindle length.
Yeah, with final spindle length. Yeah, that's right. And so now we can rule out at least the stupidest version of this limiting component model. Again, you know, whatever, there's, you know, it's all complicated. You can imagine more complicated models, whatever, right? But at least you can rule out the simplest version, right? And then again, and I think the thing which is cool about this is that, like, if one wanted to do this normally, you'd have to do a billion different perturbation experiments. You'd have to say, oh, gee, I have to find an RNAi, which, you know, screws up cell volume, but not cell length or something like that, right? Which, you know, I don't know how to do that, or, you know, maybe you have to do some complicated thing. Here you just kind of get it all for free.
There's no independent effect of cell volume.
No. And so this is now this is not an assumption. This is a statement of the correlate of the structure of the data. And so this is a statement that if you know cell length, knowing cell volume doesn't tell you anything more about final spindle length. So that's the observation of the data. No. So the whole point, this is beyond correlations. And so now we're looking at partial correlations, but not just, I mean, so this is really a structure. This is what's in the data. It could be that we can't detect. It could be that there's some incredibly small correlation, you know, partial correlation here, which we can't detect. That's definitely the case. But to the ability of our measurements, we can say that cell volume is normally, you know, cell volume and final spindle length are normally, you know, strongly correlated.
So you're assuming 0.91 is one, I guess.
No. There's no assumption. This is just the data.
You're just looking at the data to assess conditional dependence.
Why can't cell volume be? Why can't they all be independently?
No. The point is that we're not just looking at this matrix and drawing conclusions. This is just a matrix of correlations between traits. One is also looking at partial correlations, and not just. And so you can do different types of, so when you do partial correlations, right, you can hold everything fixed besides your two guys, but you can choose what you hold fixed. And it ends up that, again, like I was saying before, I mean, I should have shown it in a plot instead of just the result, but it ends up that again, like I was saying before, if you hold cell length fixed, cell volume is now, according to the best of our ability to measure, independent of final spindle length. On the other hand, if you hold cell volume fixed, cell length still depends on a final spindle length. You still have significant partial correlations between them. So that's really just, again.
How well is this? So you're conditioning on the fact that there is a spin. Failures are somehow sort of global. There's something else that could cause all these observations on top of this graphic. The first question. The second one is, what happens if there's feedback? Does that kill these approaches or not?
Well, I guess one has to be careful about what one means by this. In some sense, if you mean the right things by this, then like one could say that like one could question whether kind of feedback is even theoretically possible, depending on what you mean by these.
Like possible, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so like if really what you mean, I guess you'd be very careful what you mean. So if what you mean is that, okay, the stupidest thing. If what you mean is, if I look across lines, is there some association between this guy and that guy? Then by definition, there's, you know, you can't really have feedback. And so you just have to be careful that you're interpreting it correctly, I would say. And so it definitely could be the case that there are other possibilities. So it relates to your first point, which is entirely correct. It could be that like cell volume is in fact, right, no, it could be that there's actually no. It could be that like that like if cell length wasn't perfectly matched to final spindle size, it could be the case that if you didn't have a larger spindle and a larger cell, you'd be dead, in which case we would never see it. In which case we would, you know, we might conclude there's some mechanistic relationship between the two, but there really wouldn't be. And I guess that's what you're getting at.
It could all fall in the category of more complicated models. A factor D here, which affects cell volume and cell length in opposite ways, and that compensate for each other in spindle length. I mean, really, all you're saying, as you did say, the simplest model is knowing cell volume doesn't tell you anything more about final spindle length than you can learn from cell length alone.
Right. But there is a caveat which he's pointing out that it could just be like, in fact, maybe it would tell you more, but like everyone who that happened to is dead. And so like I should say like, yeah. So like it's you know, it's very hard to formally rule out that, so that's definitely true, right? It's very hard to formally rule out a possibility.
But for example, you may see 99% of your cells, you know, have spindles and somehow rule out that possibility.
Yeah, no. So that's definitely like most of the cells have spindles. I mean, you definitely have lines which have errors and stuff like that, but it's certainly not, but even in, you know, so these are lines which actually are alive, and so like it's, you know, it would have to be like an incredibly devious thing.
How long does it take? At once it's positioned until it's divided, how long will it take?
What do you say?
So you like squeeze the embryo, make the cell longer?
Exactly. So one can do additional tests to test these, right? And that's super interesting, right? But I think that in my mind, and definitely, you know, like, and that's the thing which Reza totally plans to do. But I think the thing which becomes more interesting is that there's other cases where it's very hard to do that, right? So for example, is that you can just throw in some other things. So for example, it ends up that the final length of the spindle, you know, also has some association with division plane and centrosome, the position of the centrosome and other things. And so while one can do some easy, you know, mechanical perturbation to test this, and in the future one can do gene knockdowns to test this, the point is that you can more or less rule out models right away, even without doing the additional, or you can rule out the simplest versions of models. And so, for example, I'll say another thing is that so the simplest version of this model, it would be that what happens, like I said, is that you have one mechanism which says that you elongate, you know, one mechanism determines the initial size of the spindle, then you elongate until maybe you get to a certain distance away from the edge of the cell, and then maybe you have another mechanism which determines the edge of that, the size of that. Distance is. If that were the case, if it was really that very simple model, then you should have, then what determines, again, in the simplest version, what determines this distance should be independent of cell size. You know, it would just be that the reason you get larger is because you just elongate until you get to a certain distance, right? So it ends up experimentally that's wrong. And so at least the simplest version of this other model is also wrong. I mean, like, we have some idea for what's really going on based on kind of more complicated things about the biology, but at least, again, you can rule out the simplest versions.
Can you just go through a little bit the notation? So like when you draw a line, this tells us something about the joint conditional probability distribution, right?
Exactly.
Can you just remind, I've seen this a long time ago, so.
Right. And so the idea is that when one draws a line like from this guy to this guy, this means that one, in the full data set, these two guys are correlated with each other. And two, if you hold everyone else fixed and you wiggle this guy, that guy wiggles. Okay?
There's no arrow,
and if there's no arrow, one doesn't know which way to point it. One doesn't know, does this call that, right? And it means that if you hold everyone else fixed and you wiggle this guy, that guy wiggles, right? So there's none of the guys who are measured are somehow in between these guys.
And so there wouldn't be a link between final chromosome size directly to initial spindle size, because if you wiggle it.
There isn't a link between which one?
It's not fully connected graph, right?
Oh yeah, totally. And so this is back to the statement, final spindle length is uncorrelated with initial spindle length.
But even within that subgraph, initial spindle length and final chromosome size are those?
Oh, sorry, centrosome size. Yeah, and so this means that this is all preliminary because like I could have made some mistakes here. This is all again a work in progress. If this were true, let's phrase it that way. This would mean that in the full data set, this guy and this guy are correlated, but if you hold this guy fixed, then this guy and that guy are uncorrelated, or yeah, that's what that would mean.
So it must be one of those three categories that you showed initially, like if you actually do the arrows.
Yeah, exactly.
So Dan, you need a lot of data or really high precision measurements to really make this work now. Is that feasible?
Oh well, and so this right here, this is all based on data.
It is.
Yeah, it's all based on data. And so some of the issues, so the reason why this is work in progress, that there are all these subtle things, like really, how do you decide if this is significant? Right, so that, you know, obviously, like, there are many different ways you can try that, and it's not at all, there are, like, caveats with everything you do. So there are definitely issues with those type of things.
I think the reason I'm having a hard time here is, I mean, there's different kinds of correlations, right? There's genetic correlations and there's environmental correlations, which...
This year, we're talking about essentially phenotypic...
Sum up with weights and heritabilities to make a phenotypic correlation. So, like that matrix you showed us, are those...
Phenotypic.
Okay. But you can have...
Oh, no, wait, hold on, no, wait, sorry, are those genetic? Are those line average? Oh, yeah, no, sorry, so it's phenotypic, these are all phenotypic.
But either way, I mean, you can have two traits that say you have a negative genetic correlation and a positive environmental correlation.
Sure.
So I guess somebody's experience like squeezing the egg, that would be something like an environmental...
You're totally right.
...correlation. This is why I'm sort of... lost here, I think.
Well,
these things are referring to what happens if you make genetic changes.
No, but I would actually take the statement that you made even farther, which is that so one has a model where one says that cell size or whatever, cell length is related to spindle length, and then you're saying, aha, if my model's correct, I think that if I squeeze this, cell length gets larger. And therefore, like, I should see a certain thing, right? But okay, that's actually a really, if you really think about what's actually going on, you know, there's a billion other things going on. It's not just the size of the cell change. Maybe it's unhappy because they're squeezing it. Well, but is it fair to grant that? It's not obvious, right? So I wouldn't equate that with the environmental. But your general point is certainly correct. And so what we're doing here is really just phenotypic. Hypothetically, one could do the whole thing with genetic as well, but right now we're doing with phenotypic.
So these correlations are based on it's between averages observed between species. And what if you look at the correlation with the natural variation within one strain? Do you see the same type of correlation?
Yes. So that's very interesting. So we haven't done this full looking at partial correlations of these different things within, I mean, so in general, one would expect them to be different. There's no particular reason why they would have to be the same, but we haven't really done that. It is true for some of the traits, if you just look at the correlation, some of them are quite similar. But again, it doesn't have to be that way, certainly.
I realized I missed a big thing. So these are, you're looking at a dynamic process, but you haven't put any timestamps on when these were measured. In
that's
principle,
right.
There's some sort of sliding thing.
That's right. And so in some sense, that's because of the sliding thing, this is why I felt confident to write in this one arrow. But any of the other arrows, I think, are very, very hard to tell. Because even though, so this is the thing which is tricky, is that one might be tempted to say, oh, things which occur first must cause things which occur later. But by the definition of causation, which one means when one is writing these, that's not true, okay. Right? In the sense that essentially it comes down to, and you can imagine many different things, but you can have something which, imagining some scenario where some unobserved thing happened at an earlier time which caused both two things to happen, and then apparently from what you've observed, it would be formally the case, you would say that a later thing caused an earlier one. And you can certainly imagine many, many simple scenarios where that type of thing would happen, even in very simple models. And so I don't think, in general, it's hard to use time ordering, I think, to really direct arrows.
You're just assuming, you're allowing the most conservative thing that these things could be very delayed reporters of all kinds of other stuff that might be happening.
Exactly.
So you don't worry if it's...
I'll give you a very concrete example of that. So look, okay, so does division plane called final spindle length or the other way around? So naively, one would think, okay, well, the spindle, you know, everyone says that there's stuff on the spindle which determines where the division plane is, and that's true, right? However, there are PAR proteins which are set up on the boundary, and it definitely could be, this is unknown if this is the case, but it could be the case, these PAR proteins actually determine, in some sense, the PAR proteins are going to tell you where the spindle is going to sit, and then that will determine where the division plane is. And as we haven't observed the PAR proteins, to us, it would look like the division plane would be causing the final spindle length.
But you could go stronger. You could say, therefore, we infer that the setup of the division plane happened at least this far in the
Exactly. But as of now, you know, we haven't. So again, the idea would be to try to use like QTL stuff to then, or other things to direct this arrow and then try to make those conclusions and then test the conclusions, you know, by follow-up. You know, either looking at labeled things or gene knockdowns or other perturbations. But I think that's a super powerful approach, and it's just very general.
Yeah.
The cell is traveling close to the speed of light with respect to the lab frame. I'm joking, okay.
So from like the biology mechanism side, the most interesting points here would be if you do have an arrow, direct arrow, or if you have no arrow, right? The others would be kind of, they would be less informative mechanistically. Is that accurate or not?
Possibly, I'm not sure. I mean, I think even, or just if you have an arrow or not.
Like, if we look at cell length and division plane, we don't know the causality there.
That's right.
But we know there's no causality between cell volume and final spindle length directly.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm trying to see, like, how would you then?
Well, so the way that we're thinking about it is kind of what I was saying before, is that, like, think of the simplest possible models that one could imagine. And so, like, these are all very reasonable models, but one can essentially, again, the simplest version of these by, like, essentially, I guess it's basically what you're saying,
looking for arrow lengths is what I'm saying. Just connections.
I would say that the way that I look at it is that we really want to figure out what's going on, and this is just something which kind of helps us figure stuff out. I also think it's a really interesting question is how to combine this type of, like, you know, probabilistic graphical model stuff with our regular cellular biophysics. I think that's really interesting. You know, in other words, like, if I write down a typical model of spindle length that makes predictions for all this stuff, and then, you know, again, using that to kind of form, you know, to test the model, which it has, I think this thing really, personally, very interesting there. And it's kind of simple if what you're measuring is the parameters of your model. Then I kind of know how to do it. But, like, you know, that's rarely going to be the case in practice, right? You know, you're going to be measuring, you know, you're measuring some output of your, some certain, you know, phenotype, which isn't really a parameter of a
biophysical. You can assign some arrows through your QTLs, and you can use those to constrain your biophysical models as to what's possible.
Yeah, that's right. That's one could do that. Yeah, no, exactly. But I do think it's interesting, challenging to say if I actually do have a good biophysical model, like, how do I relate that to this? It's not in my mind. Again, if what you were measuring were parameters, it's all very easy. But if what you have is doing more complicated, then it becomes more complicated. But another thing which I think is interesting, this is something which Rez and I have talked about a lot, is that this is really a quantitative way to rule out different models. And it is kind of an interesting point that it's a quantitative way to do it, but you don't have to know any, like, math, or you don't have to even write down a biophysical model, and you can still rule out these different biophysical models, basically, you know, without knowing anything.
So Dan, you said there was an underlying assumption of non-deviousness here.
I guess it's always, like, again, you have to use, like, Occam's razor and stuff like that. I mean, I guess it's true for anything in science, but that's true here as well, that, like...
No, but it's a strong statement. I mean, the statement is almost always, right. This thing will give the right result.
Yeah.
You're saying
fine-tuned to get the wrong result.
If someone went into your QTL, into your lines and picked the lines that will give you certain correlations, that would be...
Yeah, exactly, this type of thing, or, like... Or again, like some bizarre circumstance where, like, unbeknownst to us, I don't know. I mean, again, hypothetically, you could imagine all these awful things happening, but again, it has to really be, like, very particular, you know, bad things. I don't know formally. I mean, I know people do think about kind of formally what that means. I don't know if you're familiar with kind of formally what that means.
I mean, you're already presenting what seems to be a refinement of Occam's razor in this sense here,
statement about simple model. He doesn't have a prior on the number of lines he's going to include. Nothing like that.
You mean I could just draw the complete graph on the number of my primitive variables? And this is just some subset of that.
You mean, like, if you had like other observations and stuff like that? You mean that? I'm not sure what you're...
Well, you've got this matrix, right? And the matrix is every possible...
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, but this contains much more information than that matrix.
I see. Oh, that's right.
Okay. Yeah. And so this matrix... So this contains information on, again, partial... Maybe I should have gone into that more.
It just has to be consistent.
Partial correlations from the entire data set.
Yeah, but the data set, like, in the actual data set, one looked at partial correlations of different things, and that's how this was constructed. Yeah.
But you do have a product, actually. So in some sense, you're looking, must be some thresholding. So you're looking for the fewest lines that reasonably explain most of the data. So there is That's your Occam's razor, but.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Right, I mean, you can always make, I mean, your deviousness is an arrow that goes from cell length to initial spindle length and another feedback arrow that goes from initial spindle length.
Yeah, something like that kind of like perfectly cancels the.
Cancel each other out. I mean, you obviously can't rule that out.
Yeah, exactly, these type of things. Exactly.
So if you have an arrow towards final spindle length and you don't see the correlation between cell length and division plane and you hold final spindle length constant, doesn't that mean that the, you can put another arrow in the other way?
Wait, should I say that once more? So.
You have a special case where if you have two arrows towards something, you get a correlation.
No, you're totally right. So this, I really, in some sense, I should have drawn this without an arrow, and then because we're in the process, so we're
trying to assign arrows.
Yeah, trying to assign arrows and this other stuff. But the only reason I drew this is that, like, this is one which I do feel confident about. I mean, like, in other words, if no matter what we do, if this arrow is pointing in some other direction, there's no way I'm going to believe it. Like, you know, there's basically nothing that you could say. Well, I don't want to say, okay, like, maybe if you prove, like,
So if that's really true, would you be able to detect sort of fraud when somebody cherry picks on some other phenotype that is not on this list, but they have to send images that include at least these three or four things, and it doesn't fit sort of the baseline measurement for this species? This is a big problem these days, right? So cherry picking.
That's interesting, yeah.
And so, if you really make that strong claim, you should be able to find something like that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. That's interesting, yeah. That's
really exhausted all possible states through the isolates that you're doing these.
So, I mean, for model organisms.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. That's definitely interesting.
Yeah, I just want to say that also, like, I don't know, if you change this, but, you know, these are like in some sense in some linear regime, okay?
Yeah, sure.
You imagine if you change the size of the cell like 10 times,
sure.
Maybe like everything changes. Like,
yeah.
Then this thing doesn't hold. And usually in cell biology, we are more or less in that regime. Now we're mostly interested in gene that, you know, we change it and then something like change by factor 5 or 10.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, so some, I don't know, it depends on your answer.
This seems much more general than linear regime. I mean, we don't have to talk about correlation, we can talk about mutual information.
Yeah. Right. Well, no.
I mean, there might be a situation that, you know, deviates from this picture if you kind of push the system very hard.
That's right.
I mean, I personally will not exclude that, you know, if I see such an experiment, I'm going to say something's wrong.
Okay.
Maybe it's like just some very large deviation.
Okay.
But it raises a question, and I think it's a really interesting example and an interesting way of trying to get at this issue of cherry picking, which is indeed a big problem in cell biology.
No, that's interesting, yeah. No, definitely.
Okay, so going back to the deviousness, my understanding is that exogenous typically address the issue of particular realizations being typical picks from the distribution, right? So if you assume that A and C are independent, right, but you have one particular realization, right, it's always possible,
yeah,
but nevertheless, they happen to be completely equal to each other, although that's exponentially improbable.
Yeah.
Right? So that's sort of where, you know, probability one the statements come from. So sort of assuming that you're looking at a typical realization of data generated by a polar distribution, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true as well.
And if you have a maximum human cherry picking, it's
Yeah. But it's like, you know, you can push that to like anything, right? I mean, you could say like, you know, maybe like, I don't know, whatever. Like, every time you look at the microscope, you know, like someone like runs in and like, I don't know. Yeah, when you put on the microscope, it like goes backwards, but if it's on your desk, it goes forward. So I mean, it's possible. Yeah.
Spindle falls in a forest.
Is there anyone here? Okay, well, yeah, again, so I think it's interesting stuff personally. And I think more people should do this quantitative variation stuff, so go for it.